Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be.
Hi, I'm Carol Fitzgerald from ReadingGroupGuides.com, a website from the Book Report Network, and the host of the Book Reporter Talks To video podcast series. Welcome to our Bookachino Live book group event, where our guest this evening is my very good friend, Kristen Hanna. And we're going to be discussing The Four Winds, which received so many accolades. I don't think I can put them all like down here. It's an instant New York Times bestseller. It was a Read with Jenna selection. It was a Book Reporter Betson selection because I fell in love with this book. Besides it being top of all the major papers, including the Globe and Daily Mail. So just one of those books that hit the list and everybody said, I'm not hitting number one for a couple of weeks right now because Kristen's got that locked. So the format for tonight is going to be as follows. And let me start by noting that we assume that everyone has read the book. Okay. This is not one of those book groups you can cheat and say, I didn't read. No. So we are going to be talking spoilers. So if you haven't read, you've got to cover your ears. I'm going to begin with a discussion with Kristen, ask her a couple of questions, and then we're lucky enough that we have 9 members of the audience that will be joining us live to share their questions. And then we're going to take questions from the audience that you can drop down into the Q&A down below. When you drop your questions in there, they'll only be shared with the panelists. So just know that, you know, we really want the questions going in Q&A, everything else going into chat. And with that housekeeping behind us, Kristen, it's so nice to have you here.
Hello, it's so great to be here. Good to see you in semi-person, Carol. Thanks for everything.
It's glad we got to see each other a couple of weeks ago. I mean, that was like a real gift. It was, wow, not just, you know, talking on screens. You know, I'm going to start with this question because readers often think that writers sit down and the words just flow. And then with a few edits, a book is done. And you describe your process as being a bit more unwieldy, if I might say. Yes. So let's bust the dream for us and tell us what your writing process was like for this book, including that big change that happened somewhere along the way that sent the book in a new direction. So I think that's a great story to share.
I do have an unwieldy process and fairly unpleasant, very stressful, but it seems to be working. So I'm just gonna stick with it for a while here. With The Four Winds, which is exactly the same story that I could tell you essentially about The Nightingale and The Great Alone as well. I did like a year's worth of research on the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl and the migration to California and the work camps and everything. And, you know, created what we call a synopsis, which, as you know, is basically a narrative telling of what I expect the book to be. So I think I have the beginning, the middle, the end, I have the characters. And with this one, in the second year of work, I wrote the first draft. And I do actually write pretty quickly and pretty straightforwardly. I tend not to demand anything even close to perfection from myself. I'm just trying to get the story down in the first draft. And with this book, since most people have probably read it tonight, it was about page 450, as you know, when Elsa appeared for the first time as not even a secondary character. She was so far down the line. And it was one of those moments where I was not having any problems with the book up to that point. It was going great guns. And yet I saw Elsa and I knew instantly that I had made a mistake and that Elsa was my character. And so I threw those 450 pages and that, you know, 11 months worth of work away and started over and wrote the book that's very close to the one that you're reading.
Wow. Now, did you take those 450 pages and put them in like a Rubbermaid bucket or something to hold on to them?
You know, I keep, I do this all the time. And so I have all kinds of Rubbermaid, buckets around. And as you know, I write longhand on yellow legal pads. So I also have stacks of yellow legal pads of, you know, all of the earlier drafts. And I always sort of want to go back to them. And I often think, oh, I will at some point. But the truth is that if it didn't work once, my subconscious doesn't think it's going to work the next time either. So I just kind of leave them there.
Yeah, they're just staying there in the bucket. I also love the story about how you came up with the title, because the book was untitled for a really long time. So these are some of my favorite Kristen stories from through the years. And it's like, I don't have a title. And she's running titles by, I don't know if this is going to work. And then.
And as you know, Carol, I'm trying to find a photograph here to show you. As you know, I never have titles. I am particularly bad at them. So this was about March of 20, just before lockdown, just when I was turning the book in after, 3 years of writing it, no title, nothing going on. My team, which is Andrea Cirillo, my agent, and Jen Enderlin, my editor. I mean, we were throwing everything back and forth, texts, emails, coming up with all these wonderful things. And we just couldn't come up with anything. And then my husband and I were in LA, and we were going to see Frozen at the Pantages. We were going to take the kids. The kids all got sick. So it was my husband and I and six empty seats going to see Frozen. And we're on the LA freeway and we're parked. And this bus, I don't know if you guys can see it, pulls up right next to me. And I look across and I see the four winds. Oh my gosh, why didn't I think of this? I had actually used the sentence in the book already. And so, I texted the gang and everyone said, that's it. And we were done.
And you were able to go to Frozen completely relaxed because you now have a title. See?
And you know what? I didn't make the connection until I started doing all these talks that my character is Elsa. I mean, it's so bizarre. It's like this weird, weird universal moment.
It's like, oh, all tied in together. So we're going to go to audience questions later on the evening. So for those of you who came in a little bit late, drop those into the Q&A. We have a number of readers with us tonight who have questions. And joining us first is Debbie Moore. And Debbie's has joined us many times for these events. And tonight she's with us from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, with a few questions. So Debbie, here you go.
Hi, thank you. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Debbie.
I love all your books, and I particularly loved The Four Winds, and you discuss so many issues and events that occurred during the early 20th century, the Great Depression, the plight and treatment of women, the horrors of the Dust Bowl, and the rise of the farm labor movement. What interested you most about this period in American history?
You know what, Debbie, it's interesting because I had wanted to write about this period for a really long time, even though I really knew next to nothing about it. I mean, I believe I was, playing hooky that day in school. I'm not exactly sure. But the way it all kind of started for me was 10 years ago when I was writing The Nightingale. And then, the book came out and I started hearing from readers, particularly foreign readers or, people who had European grandparents or whatever, about what this story had meant to them, this story of women's resilience and strength and this kind of lost women's history. And I really, really wanted to write an American Nightingale, a story that would affect families in the same way, that would start conversations, that would make, grandmothers talk to granddaughters. And, that's a big thrust of mine, is to make sure that families collect and share their stories. And so right when I was trying to find my American Nightingale story, the two big things in the news were climate change and immigration, down on the border. It was every night these things were on the news. And the Dust Bowl is the greatest environmental disaster in American history. And I really loved the fact that it had been, partially created by man and by man's, you know, farming methods and lack of information about his environment, but also that it had been partially solved by man as well. I thought it just gave a really, it was a really important message. And then with regard to immigration, I just thought it was really interesting to take this whole idea of immigration and how we treat each other and how we characterize people as us and them, and do it with Americans on both sides of the equation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I got to the part in research where California closes the borders to other Americans, I just thought that was such a powerful thing. And I was hoping it would start a conversation and raise empathy, because I think, that's the great gift of fiction, to allow us to walk in other people's shoes. And also, I don't know, I guess just to raise awareness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you kind of led into my next question, which is your female characters in your three books, all of whom are really ordinary women who find the strength and courage to do extraordinary things. And certainly Elsa is one of those women. Is there a woman or women in your life on whom you've modeled these strong female characters?
You know what? It's like every mother I know. It's every woman I know. I mean, you know, no matter what is going on in our lives, and there's always a lot because we tend to be caretakers. And so not only are we now working, you know, so many of us, but we're also, you know, we're raising children, we're shopping, we're trying to keep our friends together, our families together. I'm at the age now where my dad is not feeling well, and so I'm moving into that role, you know. So I just think that women have been really extraordinary for a very long time, but it just wasn't talked about because men were doing most of the talking. And I'm thrilled for books like Nightingale to be a small part of starting this movement of remembering important women's stories.
Mm-hmm. And unearthing them, because we always heard the men's side of the stories.
Right.
Yeah.
As far as motherhood, you started to talk a little bit about that. And I certainly, you know, think that you know, for good or bad, our models of what mothers should be are our mothers. And certainly Elsa didn't have the best example of good mothering from her mother, although she had a wonderful model in her mother-in-law. And I think Elsa struggled being a good mother. Was motherhood intended? Did you intend motherhood to be a theme of this story?
You know what? That is exactly what I realized was wrong when Elsa stepped onto the page. It was not a story about motherhood. Loretta and Rafe were brother and sister, and it was this big unrequited love story. And I realized that if I was going to take on, you know, the Dust Bowl and the Depression and the migrants, that it really needed to be not so much for me a journey of self, but it needed to be a journey of saving your children. Because I think that Elsa, for example, would have stayed on the farm forever. You know, she would never have taken that risk to go west with nothing and no one, if not for her children. And I do think that is so often in history and in life, the motivator that allows women to take remarkable risk and sort of seek remarkable reward.
Mm-hmm. Take care of the Thanks book. So much. I really appreciate your answering the questions, and I'm looking forward to the next book you write.
Thank you.
Thanks, Debbie, as always. Myrna Greenberg is going to join us now from Coconut Creek, Florida, and she's going to be sharing her questions with us as well. So Myrna, can you do your camera and sound? Let's just see. Saw her before. Let me see. If not, I can do her question. I have all the questions here. So Myrna, if you can't jump on board. Okay, here we go. So this month, my group read Magic Hour, which was a spectacular success. our members' love of the characters and the time you took to research it. So many found details that resounded in their own lives. Each of your books is so different. How do you select a theme to develop a story, including the one that you did for The Four Winds?
Oh, well, thank you for saying they're different. I try to sort of not do the same thing over again, even though they're all very thematically similar. I didn't realize this for years that I was writing about women overcoming extraordinary odds until I started, you know, to look back at it. Each book has its own sort of genesis, its own moment. I mean, ever since Nightingale and The Four Winds and my next book have very much been me in search of moments in history that women made an impact in that I believe have been overlooked. So that's one kind of book. Magic Hour was really one of those things that just kind of presented itself to me. I was watching the news one night. I live in Washington State, and we have deep, dense, dark rainforests, very like Maine, you know, and Alaska, some of those kinds of dark forests. And there was a news story about two young boys who walked out of the woods one day and said they had never seen human beings before. And it was this very small town in British Columbia, actually. And the town embraced these boys and took care of them and, you know, all of that. So it turned out, of course, that they were like from Encino and the whole thing was a lie. But I was so fascinated with this idea that you could live in off the grid in that way. And that led me to research about feral children, children that grow up in wolf packs or, you know, completely sort of untethered to human contact. And I just found that a fascinating story. So I followed it.
Mm-hmm. That's how the stories start finding you at the same time. Yeah, you're exactly in quest of them and they're finding you. Terry Cable is going to join us now. Terry can jump on. There you are, Terry. So good to see you. She's from Detroit Lakes, Minnesota.
Hi, Carol. Thanks again for doing this. I look forward to it every month. Kristen, so nice to see you and get a chance to talk with you. My first question is, your writing has evolved over the long term from being what I would call more contemporary themes to being deeply written, researched novels that examine hardship. Could you share with us how your growth as a writer has evolved from way back when to now? Because
that is a great question. Thank you. You know, I think actually it's the aging process, to be honest. You know, when I wrote my first book, I had a newborn baby and I was 28 years old, I guess, wrote my first book. And so my mother had just died of breast cancer. And so I was in this place where I felt very sort of untethered and uncertain. And you know how every young mother, you're like, where's the instruction manual? And when you don't have your mother on top of it, you are really sort of, you know, in the wilds. And so I wrote books that were very sort of love and relationship and family forward. And I only had, you know, an hour a day. Those first like five books I had to write during nap time, school time, you know, the catch as catch can while I'm sitting in the carpool lane, that kind of thing. And as my son grew up and, you know, needed me less, you know, got to the point in eighth grade where he said, for the love of God, stop coming to the school, you know, so now I had more time to write and I was older and I was looking at the world a little bit differently. Firefly Lane, you know, the series that's out now was very much, I think, me leaving the world of other people's lives and moving into the things that matter to me deeply as a 40-year-old. And then, you know, I hit another big milestone at 50, I think. And that's where Nightingale came from. Suddenly I had a granddaughter, I have a daughter-in-law, and I just really wanted to write stories that would, I guess, like I said before, would help people talk about their own histories. Because when you lose your mother young, you lose your family history. So our stories are largely gone. And I just find that so important to do. Mm-hmm. And then I work really hard at getting better. I mean, honestly.
And you've done very well at it. Thank you. My other question, and I suspect it's one that others have as well, is Elsa's husband leaves. We never hear from him again.
Yeah. You know, I wrote those scenes, Terry. They're out there. I know where he is. I know what he was doing. I know what was going on. But what happened was, and I wrote versions where they connected in California, you know, where he came back into her life for whatever reason. But the bottom line was that by the time he came back, every time, the truth was it didn't matter anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't her story. And, you know, so it really only mattered for his daughter, Loretta, and she has her own journey someday. So I just didn't want to have this. I tried these big scenes where Elsa, you know, basically says to Rafe, why'd you leave? And the truth was that his leaving was in many ways the best thing that ever happened to her, you know, and she grew up enough to know that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. Next, we've got Laura Beth Viter from Summerfield, North Carolina, with her question. So Laura Beth will come on there. There you are. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks, Carol, for having me. First off, I'm really excited that you just said Loretta might have her own adventure. I hope that was a hint, but that's not my question. I'll save that in case somebody else has it. But my question is, your landscapes are so developed and your characters so relatable that we feel the dust in our eyes and the grit in their bones. So how were you able to submerge yourself in this time period for such a sensory experience of the Dust Bowl?
Well, first of all, it all comes from the research. I mean, there's nothing, you know, there these scenes where the dust hits and the centipedes crawl out of the walls. You know, I'm not good enough to make that up. This is stuff that, you know, that I have read that has impacted me so much that, you know, I pass that research along to you in a way so that you can basically live through this and get all of my knowledge without having to read the 400 books it takes, you know, to sort of get there. But I think that the reason that my books are so immersive in both character and in setting is really twofold. One is that my entire youth was the geek books, you know, Tolkien and my husband's bringing me wine. Hang on. Thank you.
Ben.
So Tolkien, Dune, you know, all of those kinds of world building books. And I loved how, like you said, immersive they were. And so I really feel that it's my job to take Seattle today. And it's still my job to make you feel it, smell it, believe it. And then the other thing is, I often hear that my books are slow in the beginning. So it must be true because I hear it a lot. And I think that the reason that you cry at the end is because they're so, I'm taking so much time to set it up in the beginning. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it definitely had that old man in the sea effect where we just feel that struggle all along. And it was just beautifully done. And thank you so much. I don't think I ever needed so much water reading a book, but I did. So it was really fantastic. So thanks, Kristen.
dry mouth. Well,
hydration is important, so I'll take that as a good thing.
We'll stay hydrated.
Yeah.
And dust your house for all the dust that came in. There you go. There you go. Thanks, Marbeth, for joining us as always.
Thank you.
Cindy Rosella is going to join us now from South Florida with a question. We are bringing in around the country for you, Kristen. Yeah, that's where we're going. Hi, Cindy.
Here I am. Hi, Kristen. How are you?
I'm exactly
at the other end of where you are.
Yeah, the exact opposite. That's true.
Exactly. Complete opposites. You know, there must have been so much historical information research for you doing the Four Winds. I'm wondering, how did you decide what to keep in and what to leave out?
You know, I mean, that, of course, that's the difficulty. And I think I am like most authors who put in a lot of time to do historical research. My first like four or five or six drafts really tell you every single thing I know. And, you know, figures out how to use every bit of it. And at some point, I begin to realize that I have essentially written a textbook, you know, with cardboard characters, because I'm so interested in giving you all of the facts, all of the feelings, all of the politics, you know, everything I have to say. And that's when the book shifts. I put everything in place historically, and then I tell myself, now it is no longer a historical novel. Now it is about these characters, because a novel, or at least my kind of novel, requires characters in conflict for you to keep reading. You know, something like you have to go, what's next? What's going to happen? What's going to happen? And that was another problem with the whole first draft of this book. There was so much bad stuff happening, right? You got the dust, you got the drought, you got the animals, you got no money. And you're thinking, or I was as a novelist, how do people fight? You know, how is there conflict when really these are five people who love each other trying to stay alive? And that's when I went, an adolescent girl, she will fight with a sponge if there's no one else around, right? And yes, that's when the book suddenly became, I think, relatable. It's a mother-daughter story that we all know, that we all understand, that we all believe. And, you know, you put the mother's lack of self-esteem with the daughter's belief that she knows everything. And, you know, this is just a world that we know. And so I'm able to use them as a prism to teach you as much as I can about the era without boring you. That's really my goal.
Well, thank you very, very much. I learned a lot about the Dust Bowl.
Thank you.
The Depression and all that.
They didn't teach us. I mean, these it wasn't taught much.
No, and that's another reason why I enjoyed your book. Not many books have been written.
Yeah.
You know, focusing on the Dust Bowl and that whole time that was very difficult for Americans. Thank you for writing it.
I also never knew the people who were Italian, because I'm from Italian descent, lived in that part of the world, like a part of the country. I didn't know that. And when I started reading that, I was very, very surprised, because I had never thought that anybody had journeyed that far west. And that was very interesting,
you know, to
me.
To be totally accurate, Carol, it was a little unlikely for them to be that far north. They mostly stayed down on the coast.
Okay.
But, you know.
Even if they were in anywhere, I was surprised. Yeah. If they made it to Texas, I was surprised. Though we're still making, like, you know, pasta on the East Coast.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us, Cindy. It's so good to see you.
Thank you. Indeed.
Okay, Olivia Likes, I think that's how I pronounce it, from Bowling Green, Kentucky, is joining us now. So Olivia, it's so great to see you.
Olivia,
I don't think I've seen you before.
Nope, I've never done one of these before. So I'm very excited to be here and to talk to you. My question was, because I did not see it coming, I didn't feel it coming when Elsa died. So my question was, did you always kind of know, I guess once you realized Elsa was the main character, was that always what you had in mind for her or no? And if not, when and how did you come to that decision in the writing process?
No, I did not see it coming and I did not want it to happen. And I probably wrote 16 different endings.
Wow.
And just from the moment of the strike, you know, so a 15-page period, I just kept trying and trying and trying. And what ultimately was the answer for me was what she stood for was so important. And I wanted it to hit people so hard, what she had risked and what she had risked for and what mattered to her. And there was no other ending that underscored it as powerfully as that one.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. It was, when I first read it and first digested it, I was just like, how after everything she's gone through and fought through, this is what, you know, it comes down to, but that totally makes sense.
I did give her, you know, love story and pretty good sex. So there was, you know, something in there.
Well, thank you for answering my question.
Olivia, thank you so much for joining us. Now we've got Lynette Cortez, who is joining us from Effort, Pennsylvania, with some questions.
Hi, Kristen. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I think my question was already answered, but anyway, this is exciting. My book club is actually discussing The Four Winds this coming Friday.
Oh, yay. Thank you.
So it's really good to bring this information to them. I think a couple might be on, actually. But anyway, Laredo was such a strong, fierce character that I grew to love. I did not like her in the beginning at all.
No.
I was so upset when the book ended. Like, I wanted to know more about her and her accomplishments. Will there be a sequel? Like, have you toyed with the idea? I would love to know more. Like, what happened to Rafe? Where did he go? Like,
you know, I always, the minute that it became Elsa's book, I imagined that Loretta had a book. And I really, really, really want to write it. The problem is kind of two, there's a couple of them. One is that I'm like you, I started out, you know, not loving Loretta and ended up loving her. And I want her to have learned everything that her mother had to teach her, and then to take that, you know, twice as far again in her version. And unfortunately, I drop her back in California right at the beginning of World War II. And I don't really want to write about Loretta in World War II and the home front. And so I am in search of a story that is as powerful and as ambitious and unique as this character is.
I have faith you'll find it. This was so well written.
I'm looking.
Just like The Great Alone and Homefront, like this truly touched my soul, like as a woman and a mother. It was amazing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Lynette, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Stephanie Kaisau from Santa Barbara, California is now going to join us. Please. Stephanie around? Stephanie coming? Turn on camera? If not, I can do Stephanie's question. Let me do that. Okay. I find such similarity with Elsa's adversity and someone like myself struggling at work, deciding between staying at a toxic workplace and a job I love, or leaving it and moving to the unknown. What is the underlying message of Elsa's resilience to us in the post-pandemic world? Because she moved on, she took that big step.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting. Of course, I could not have known when I turned in The Four Winds. I mean, as I said earlier, I turned it in the final draft the week that Seattle went on lockdown for this pandemic. And it did really, you know, having just spent 3 years on the Great Depression, it did really put the pandemic in perspective for me. Mm-hmm. And I guess I think that it's so difficult, especially as a woman, especially if you've got, you know, children to care for, you know, a single mother is just, it's so difficult to try to figure out when you take risk and when you don't. And I would say that it's fairly clear that I'm a risk averse person, because like Vian in The Nightingale and Elsa in The Four Winds, these women do not make that jump lightly. You know, the risk has to be basically where I am and what I am doing is untenable. And, you know, you're talking about like a toxic work environment. This kind of situation has long-term physical and emotional and self-esteem, you know, kinds of issues. And so, you know, I guess I just say to women, you know, we are so smart, we're so powerful, we are so strong, that you just have to believe in yourself and listen to that little voice inside of you. And, you know, and when you decide to go, you got to go all in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, I worked at Condé Nast for 17 years and I could have stayed there. Instead, in 1995, I decided to open an internet company with one site on AOL. So let's just see, it totally changed the trajectory of my life. And one was safe and the other one was sort of this leap like over the cliff. And what do? But over the cliff really seemed to work because I'm still having a good time. I don't think I'm going to have a good time staying there. Nancy from Albrightsville, Pennsylvania shared a question for me to ask. Was the mantra Elsa told herself about carrying the penny with her inspired by E.E. Cummings' poem, I carry your heart with me, I carry it in my heart. I kept remembering the poem while I'm reading and I was curious.
No, that is a great question. You know, who knows? It could be subconscious because I know that I have used that poem with regard to grief in novels at other moments. So that's a poem that really resonates with me as as well. But I don't think it certainly wasn't on the top of my mind when I came up with the penny. The thing that was really interesting about the penny was I was looking for, you know, a symbol, something that could be passed from person to person that would essentially encompass the American dream. That's what the penny was meant to represent. And so when I looked back and found, you know, that there was a penny of the era that had wheat on the back, I just thought, you know, it's one of those, I got chills moments where I went, okay, the universe is telling me this penny is what I'm looking for.
You have it framed in your office now? Is a penny framed?
I wish. No.
Down to the last cent. Gail from Cincinnati asked me to share this question. In general, I think readers often wonder about the story of other characters in the book that aren't followed up on. And I'm wondering whether authors have the same curiosity. And obviously, since the author didn't write their stories, it can be whatever the reader wants it to be. I know you didn't include this information because it wasn't part of the story you were telling. Well, do you ever wonder what happened to Elsa's parents, her sister and her husband? Did it ever go through your head? Like, what happened to those people?
I mean, you know, in my head, they lost everything and were not the kind of people who were durable. They were not the kind of people who knew how to fight for what they wanted and had no idea how to ask for help. So I assume they ended up in some Hooverville somewhere. Living in a box, I wrote very many versions of that because I really, the human in me wanted Elsa to confront them, to get some kind of closure with them, the same as with Rafe. But when push came to shove, I thought it said more about how they treated her and how they felt about her that they left without saying a word. And that was more powerful than any words I could come up with.
Really good. Really good. Tony from Parkersburg, West Virginia is going to join us with a question. Tony, I just want you to know that you have the distinction of being the first man who has joined one of our book groups. So I'm so excited to have you here.
Well, I hear you got some big questions here, Tony. What's going on?
First, I want to say, hi, Kristen. Hi, Carol. Thank you for having me. I discovered your work with Firefly Lane. If you put Katherine Heigl in something, I'm going to tune in. And then I had to devour the book. And then that led me down the rabbit hole of all your other work. Yeah. I am sure that everyone here who has read many of your books has a personal favorite, myself included. And I was just wondering what yours was, whether that be the favorite story that you've written or the writing process, what just makes one stand out as a favorite to you?
Okay, well, first, so let me just go back to what you said. So you watched the series first and then you read the book?
I did.
Ah, okay. So I will want to hear a little information on that. Let me okay. grill you on that in a minute. You know, the interesting thing about writing is that, you know, you spend all this time, you put all of your, you know, yourself and everything you've got into every book. And then the book goes out into the world and you discover that it's something slightly different when it's received than it was in your hands. So for me, my favorites are the novels that either redefined or changed my career, or I was somehow changed by the process of writing it. And those are Firefly Lane, On Mystic Lake, Winter Garden, The Nightingale, and actually, sorry to be rude, but the next book. Mm-hmm. So that sort of is that. And I did, just as a small aside, I got to watch Firefly Lane, the new season yesterday. I sort of binged it for 2 days. And it was the most surreal thing because for 15 years, I've been hearing what Firefly Lane means to people. You know, people come up to me, they write me letters. Oh my gosh, you know, they're crying when they talk to me and they want to share, you know, the power of these characters in this relationship and this story with me. But because it's mine, I never quite own a book the way a reader does, you know? And then I watch, you know, the last half of season two, and Katherine Heigl and Sarah Chalk gave me this gift of letting me be the audience for my own book for the first time. And it was a remarkable experience, you know, it was amazing.
I bet. I just can't imagine how that must feel.
You know, while Tony's here, the other thing you've talked about a lot, Kristen, is you write in these 7-year cycles or these 7-year, yeah. And it's like, it was Firefly Lane was a defining part in your career. Nightingale, defining part in your career. Even we could say Night Road was a defining point in your career of like, you know, what would happen with that book. So, you know, there's so many things that have happened along the way with your books. So can you talk a little bit about that 7-year, like, and then I moved in a new direction.
I didn't know. That's another thing. I didn't see it until I saw it in retrospect. So at the first 7-year mark, I wrote a book called On Mystic Lake, which was my first hardcover foray into women's fiction. Which, by the way, you know, I was a historical romance novelist and not a hugely successful one. Nobody wanted me to go hardcover. And there was no women's fiction at the time to speak of, really. And so here I write this book and it changes, you know, it gives me this platform. And then I realized 7 years later, I write Firefly Lane. And that is me leaving sort of the safety of me understanding what women's fiction is and me trying to write a book that at the time I described as an anthem for my generation, where music and pop culture shaped us. So that's what, and that was a big change. It wasn't it wasn't a love story. It was about these two women who were essentially almost soulmates, right? And then 7 years later, almost to the day, I write The Nightingale and leave contemporary fiction, you know, behind. And I was kind of doing the math. I think I'm there. So I don't know what's next. But I think it just has to do with this idea that once I feel comfortable writing something, I don't want to write it anymore. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I want to be scared all the time, mm-hmm. And feel challenged all the time. And just Tony, I'm just going to tell you, I will tell Ms. Hagel what you had to say, because she will love to hear that. She is the nicest, smartest, most passionate woman.
I don't know that I can handle Katherine Hagel knowing that I exist.
Take the vapors. There you go. Tony, thanks so much for joining us. We're glad you got out early enough to be able to join us tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank
you. You know, Kristen, I know this question's on readers' minds. So what is happening in the TV? Well, you know, I joked the other day, I was doing an interview with Michael Connelly and Anthony Horowitz, and I said, you can't just write a book anymore. Immediately people say, so what about the movie? Is there going to be a series? What's going to happen? And it used to be you could just write a book and it was fine. So first of all, Nightingale. Well, it was, everything was really on track. And then?
Everything was great. We have Ellen Dakota Fanning, and we were all in Budapest, ready to start filming. Their first day of filming was supposed to be March 15th, 2020. And obviously COVID shut them down. And then everybody sort of scattered for, you know, 2.5 years. Nobody knew what to do. What was the silver lining to all of this, and this, your book club and your efforts to publicize books and authors, is really part of the whole silver lining of the pandemic, because what people did in lockdown was read, mm-hmm. you know, whether it was audio or, you know, whatever the format they loved, they began reading and reading and reading. And I think that has so enriched all of us that, you know, it's a great thing. But anyway, back to The Nightingale. So the bottom line is, it's gearing back up. And all I can say is I'm hopeful. You know, we have a beautiful script. We have a cast. We now just need a director and, you know, a way to go forward.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, people don't quite understand until you really get into this, how many of the pieces have to come together. Oh. You've got to have, yes, the studio, yeah. But the studio's got to have the director. You've got to have the right writer. Then you've got to have the Fanning sisters able to do this both. And so many people took different roles over this last 2.5 years, yeah. That it's like, oof, you know?
It's shocking. You know, I remember that when I went up for, they do something called a table read, which is where the whole cast sits around a table and reads the script out loud and, you know, in their own parts for Firefly Lane. And I did that whenever, however many years that was ago. And I'll never forget, like, driving up to the studio, the set, whatever it is, a soundstage, and there are thousands of people mm-hmm. involved. I mean, you know, from drivers to caterers to costumers to lighters. I mean, it's like a whole community of people that are charged with putting this thing together. And film is really collaborative. Mm-hmm. And as you know, Carol, I am very, very collaborative. I love to edit. I love to hear from people. But I really like to be where the buck stops. I like to be the decision maker. Yeah. And that's not the case in Hollywood. So it can sometimes be a little tricky for me.
Mm-hmm. It's a whole new thing. But meanwhile, Firefly Lane, the end of the second season starts tomorrow night on Netflix. Tomorrow night, yeah. Thursday night on Netflix. So everybody can catch up on that. You know, it's interesting what you say about, because I was interviewed Michael Connelly last week. We're talking about Bosch and that beautiful house up on top of the cliff. And he says, yeah, great house, right? says somebody owns that house. They're not out there that much. It's at the top of a windy road. So you have to not only get the house, when you get the house, you have to pay off everybody on the street.
Oh yeah.
Because they can't leave their houses. And you've got to get all your truck and everything supplies up there. And you got to pay everybody to do that. He says, so what's really interesting is if there are 10 episodes and six, let's say, have to be in that house, you have to have those six directors that are directing those days available to go up and do this. So I think the puzzle piece of the way the whole film comes together is you're not doing things in real time. Anthony Horowitz's wife was telling me that sometimes they needed an actress and she was going to go be on The Crown. So they had to shoot all her scenes completely out of, and we're just not used to that. We're used to being very linear of what's going on. And like, why are you just doing the pancake scene when it doesn't come in?
Yeah. Well, Sarah Chalk, who plays Kate, was talking today in an interview, and she was talking about one of the very difficult Firefly Lane scenes, of which there are a lot. I mean, it's such an emotional story. And so she's like deep in character and she's getting ready to do something really difficult. And the guy next door starts leaf blowing, you know, every single time. And she's, you know, or whatever, or a boat goes past or a seagull screams, you know. And so there are so many pieces to the filming, and it's years of decision making happening before you ever get there. Mm-hmm. You know, and then on top of that, I was so lucky and grateful to get people like Catherine and Sarah and Ben, you know, involved, because you never know who's going to make it or what it's going to turn out like. There's no guarantee that they will follow your book or, you know, do it justice.
Mm-hmm. But you also did get the chair with your name on it. Did you get the chair with your name?
I did. I think I have it back here somewhere. Yeah.
I keep telling everybody that you need to get the chair with your name on it. And I said, Kristen Hannah got the chair with their name. So anytime somebody says, I said, no, you're going to go on set. You got to get this chair with your name. Okay. We're come back at the very end to another question. But right now we're going to go to some reader questions. So can our voice of God, Tom Donadio, can you find some questions for us?
Yes, here I am. And we do have some good questions. First, a question from Marcia. She asks, did you have family living during the Dust Bowl era? This book is my favorite, as I felt so connected to the struggles.
Oh, thank you so much. My Canadian relatives live in Saskatchewan, just above North Dakota. And that's really as close as any of my family was to the Dust Bowl. We were much more, you know, way west, all of us. Thank you. But I did, Tom, I saw a question kind of scroll by. I couldn't read the whole thing, but it was something about domestic violence or abuse, and this woman was an abuse counselor. If you can find that kind of interested me. I didn't know. I couldn't tell.
Is that in the chat?
Yeah. Oh, it might be in the chat. Okay, I'll look in the chat.
Okay, go ahead, Tom.
Go ahead.
Trying to find it myself.
Okay, I'll try and find chat. Okay.
Okay. I'll ask another question. From Diane. She asked, did you ever live in Alaska?
Oh, Diane, thank you. Yes. My family's business for 20 years has been a sport fishing lodge on the Kenai and a bear camp up on Lake Clark. And so my son, my brother, my dad, my sister, everybody has at some point in time worked at the camp. And only in the summer, I point out, none of us have stuck around in the winter. But I am just, I'm both an uber fan of the beauty and the danger of the Alaskan landscape. And I also wanted to just give people a little glimpse into the kind of people who choose to live off the grid when there's no safety. And I find that fascinating. And actually, that is the closest I've ever been, I think, to the kind of thriller-esque, horror-esque books that I love to read.
I think I found the chat from Beth. So she said that she was chatting about the accurate portrayal of abuse and the impact of trauma on a survivor. And that's something that she felt, I believe, came across in your books. I think I've got that correct.
Awesome. Well, thank you. I really, really appreciate that. You know, one of the challenges of The Great Alone that was so important to me was I wanted to do this sort of what I hoped was an accurate portrayal of why women stay in these dangerous relationships and how that kind of choice impacts the children who are both innocent bystanders and sometimes co-conspirators, or, you know, they're all pulled into this dangerous, dangerous web. And it's so easy for all of us to sit back and go, well, she, you know, she should have left. And so I really wanted to talk a little bit about what love is, how love goes bad. And of course, one of my favorite themes, which I've done repeatedly, is the trauma of PTSD and how we failed our Vietnam vets, and you know, and how they came home, and some of them, you know, were forever scarred by this. Mm-hmm. And then there's Lenny, who has to sort of learn to survive on her own in spite of her parents. And I always find that fascinating.
Mm-hmm. And that was the book, The Great Alone. You actually wrote three different times, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I did.
You did that. It was like, what was it? A thriller, then from the guy's point of view. And that I'm sharing with the readers just because it's when you see the finished book, the behind the scenes is so interesting of to get to that place. You wrote the book in different voices to get to the voice in the story you ended up with.
Well, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot of writers who plan a book, who research a book, and then, you know, write the book that's in their head. Mm-hmm. And I would love to be that writer. I was for 15 years when, you know, when I had, you know, kids at home, and I was, you know, going on field trips and making cookies and doing all that kind of stuff. I didn't have the kind of luxury that I do now to follow a character like Elsa. Mm-hmm. But now I do really, I just find it, like I said, it's working. I mean, the minute it stops working, I will stop doing it because it's onerous and vaguely depressing, frankly, to realize that, you know, you've made a mistake. Mm-hmm. And what my readers, Megan Chance, as you know, is one of my, is my primary reader. She's a historical fiction novelist herself. And, you know, they would be quick to tell you that the other drafts are publishable. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I'm writing, they're good books. They just don't hit whatever note it is I'm trying to hit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you've got it. And sometimes, I mean, even when I write the newsletter openers, there's sometimes I've got it. And there's sometimes I'm telling, I got nothing. I got nothing.
You know, Carol, you know, I can write a whole book and not a newsletter. So, you know, come on.
That's funny. That's really funny. Tom, do you have another question?
We do. Yeah. Actually, a few readers are asking, they're curious if you, how much you were influenced by The Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah. Well, it's impossible not. I mean, that is the singular record of the era, essentially. It's you know, I read it in college like everybody else did. It's a remarkable book. I read it again, you know, while I was researching. And I wouldn't say that I was, I wasn't influenced by it any more than I was influenced by any of my research. But it was just very masculine. You know, it was very much about what the men were doing. And I was much more interested in Ma Jode, you know, and, you know, some of the female characters. So I actually think that it's a great compliment that they they tell the story together well, because Grapes of Wrath didn't do much with the Dust Bowl itself. You know, it was more the migration. So I think they go together very well. And one of my favorite stories I found on research, in fact, was that there was a young woman novelist who was living in the Weed Patch camp, taking care of the migrants. And she was interviewing all of them, making notes, and writing her version of what she called the Great American Novel about the migration to California. And unbeknownst to her, all of these notes that she was giving to her boss about the migrants, her boss was giving to John Steinbeck. So essentially, he was getting all of her research. And so she sold her book to the great Bennett Cerf at Random House and flew back there, and they were working on it. Everyone thought it was going to be, you know, an out of the ballpark hit. And then Grapes of Wrath came out, and she was unable to sell her book for 40 years because that story had been told. And the irony is that when you read it, it's a book called Whose Names Are Unknown. It's completely different. You know, it's a woman's story. It's very different than the Grapes of Wrath, but still, you know, she couldn't tell it.
That's what happened. Tom, anything else?
Yeah, we have a question about your research process. An anonymous attendee says, I'm curious about your research process, the nuts and bolts of it. How and where do you take notes, keep them organized, find what you need when you need it, et cetera?
Well, so it goes in stages. So first off, let's say I've chosen the Great Depression because of the what I feel resonates today, right? So that, let's say I start there. I pick the Great Depression. So then I begin researching the Great Depression all across the country, all across the world. What's going on, what started it, the social, geopolitical, you know, all of the things that led to it. And I'm looking for a way in. I'm looking for where my story is to be told. And of course, if you're researching the Great Depression and you're an author like me and you're looking for the most difficult times that you can do, you find the Dust Bowl and you're like, oh, well, that's as bad as life can get, you know? So now I know where my book is set. Now it's, you know, in this circle of states. And then I begin researching who lives there, what happened, what was the Dust Bowl like for them, and you know, begin. And then that's when I start reading memoirs, you know, like, you know, that's where the real sort of pay dirt is. What people who lived through this wrote in their diaries, in their journals, in their newspaper articles, and I interview people if I can. And then I take, you know, so let's say it's 400 books. So I take notes for all those books. I put each note on its own note card, and I then organize those note cards chronologically. And that, as much as anything, becomes the spine of my story. And then I have to begin, like I said earlier, I then have to transition from a historical textbook to a novel about people. Mm-hmm. And that's when it becomes the most creative. And at that point, I really try to stop researching as much as I can and just write.
You know, I was watching an interview that you did with Adriana a couple of weeks ago. And when you two were talking about the memoirs that you read, like around that time, like when you were doing your research, I found that so interesting. And you both had said reading memoir helped so much because you felt like people were right in that place and they were sharing their stories that gave you that feeling of what was there now. It's really interesting.
It really is. I mean, it's as close as you can get to sort of sitting in the room, and especially women's memoirs, you know, because men's memoirs, which I also read, of course, but they tended to be about when they planted, what went on, what happened with the water, what happened to the crops, what were the prices, you know, very sort of matter of fact things, which were all important. But the women would tell, you know, like how we made pancakes out of flour and water, how we, you know, how we fed our children with nothing, how we pickled tumbleweed, you know, so that we could feed our kids. And so you kind of put it all together. And then, like I said earlier, my job is to make it so that you end up with vastly more knowledge than you went in with, while also asking yourself, because of the characters, what would I have done in this situation? And what can I, as a human, as an American, learn about resilience and strength and determination from the greatest generation?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tom, I think we've got time for one or two more. Do you have one or two?
Yeah, we have a couple more here. Denise says, The Four Winds was so well written and yet sad, heavy, and many times I wanted to stop to get away from the sadness. How did you keep going? How did you take care of yourself?
You know, it's funny. I certainly hear that a lot, and I certainly understand it and respect it. And I look back in retrospect and, you know, try to learn from it and ask myself if there isn't a way to work harder at balance. You know, scenes like the beauty shop scene, scenes like the guy who lets her go out of the hospital, the scene where Elsa takes the gun and, you know, grabs the aspirin. Maybe I should have done more of those scenes to alleviate it. But the point of this book was, this was a really dark, dangerous, mm-hmm. difficult time, mm-hmm. and people survived it. And of course, the message that I didn't know I was presenting, which the world ended up needing at the moment of the pandemic, was we have been in worse places than this and we have survived. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think to some extent the argument can be made that we aren't quite as tough as we used to be and we don't come together as well as we need to anymore to mm-hmm. protect each other. We're so divided. And so I think a book like The Four Winds can remind people that you don't have to have everything in common. You don't have to believe all the same things, but we are all Americans and we all need to be working for the betterment of all of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very true.
Very true.
Okay, and now we're gonna wrap it up with this from Maureen. She says, Loretta said to her mom, Elsa, you haven't failed me, you saved me. What advice or guidance do you have for mothers in today's society? Is there such a thing as balance? I'm an elementary school teacher and mom of a daughter with special needs. P.S. You are an icon. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Lovely.
You know, it's so funny. I was just talking to my girlfriends about this. We were having wine the other night and talking about this. And one of the things I realized, because you only, is it Kierkegaard, you only, you know, understand life afterwards, not, you know, forwards. And I realized that when I was a young mom, trying to write and being really the mom I wanted, that was the most important thing to me, that I was always present, that I was always involved and, you know, doing everything. So it gave me very little time to write. And then, of course, I had my husband and I had my family and, you know, all of that. What I realized was that for 15 or 20 years, 15 years at least, I rarely saw my girlfriends. I rarely was able to have a social life of my own, you know? And so one of the things I value right now and I protect and I take care of is time for my girlfriends. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying I would do anything differently. I wouldn't. We have to make choices. There is a finite amount of time in the world. And, you know, you have to pick the things that either make you happy and fulfill you or move you in the direction that you want to go. And, but I do think that it is so important. And I think this is why it's always in my books. It is so important to take care of and nurture your female friendships. Because when times get tough, and they will, they are the people who will keep you standing.
Mm-hmm. I know you said that many times during the pandemic. Like, it was like, oh, wine with the girlfriends, gonna go do that. Wine with the girlfriends, gonna save me.
And, you know, we were just talking about it the other day. There was that period, at least here in Seattle, you know, every community was different, but I would invite my best girlfriend, Megan, and her husband over, and they would bring their own wine. They would bring their own snacks. They would sit on one side of the deck. We would sit on the other side of the deck. It was Seattle, so it was freezing. We're in our coats. Or I would go see my dad, and he'd sit in his car and I'd sit in my car, and we'd talk back and forth, you know? And so I think what it reminded all of us, how much connection matters, and how much you need to sacrifice to make that connection happen.
I had a friend last Friday night. She wanted to go out, but she wanted to sit outside, and it got cold. She goes, "Did you bring your jacket?" I said, "Karen, only for you will I be wearing my jacket sitting outside tonight, eating pizza and salad. Only for you. So I know that you've been working on something new, and I'm very impressed that that has not come up in the questions tonight. So I just want to think, let me see if I can get this right, that readers should follow you on Facebook and Instagram for whenever the news breaks. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yes. And I believe I would look closely in the next 3 weeks.
Okay. There you go. Guys, this is your clue. Okay. This is your clue. Follow Kristen on social media, on Instagram and Facebook, over the next 3 weeks. Kristen, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed having you here tonight. It was a very, very special evening that you delivered for our readers. Thank you so very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much, you guys. Thank you to everyone, to all of the writers out there. Keep writing. And for all of you book lovers and readers, on behalf of myself and all of my author pals, we so appreciate your support, your enthusiasm, your following us, your reviews, good or bad, wherever they are. You know, you being a part of the book loving community is really important.
Oh, that's so great. That's so great. So everybody keep writing those reviews. They do read them. They do want to know what's going on. And for everybody who wants to know what's next, our next Book of Chino Live book group is on a Tuesday, not a Wednesday, May 30th at 8 o'clock, where Laura Dave is going to be joining us to discuss The Last Thing He Told Me, which has been adapted to the screen by Laura and her husband, Josh Singer, who won the Academy Award for Spotlight, and it's currently airing on Apple TV. And it will end before the, before we have this next conversation. So sign up's going to be available on Book Reporter Reading Group Guides. We're going to make this night's talk available on YouTube and our podcast later this week. And to stay on top of what we're doing, don't forget, you just sign up for the Book Reporter newsletters, and we'll keep you up to date on everything. Kara, Kristen, thank you so much for joining us. And everybody
thanks
else,
everybody.
Have Bye. A very nice night.
Take care. Thanks for coming on, you guys. I appreciate your questions.
Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To.